Get going. It's a great pleasure to welcome Robin Franklin from the University of Cambridge. It's great to see such a good turnout. It's entirely appropriate for Robin. And I do remember almost 2 years to the day that I thought that I would get a really good audience for this, some of you will remember, for these seminars, which I've been organising for the last 3 or 4 years. And so I said to all the graduate students that it was compulsory. And they all turned up, and we were as full as this. And I think I said at the time, it was the first time that anything that I'd actually written had actually been undertaken by the people to whom it was written. So anyway, it's nice as I come to the end of my time as head of the department to see such a great turnout for a great speaker. So, Robin, I've known for a number of years. I've been involved because he's director of the MS Society's, let me get the name right, I should know it now, their Cambridge Centre for Marlin Repair, and I've been chairing the sort of, if you like, the advisory committee that goes up there every so often. For
probably getting on for 10 years, I should think,
something like that.
So just a little bit about Robin. He, first of all, did a degree in physiology at University College, got a first, and then he went to the Royal Veterinary College.
Did you ever practice as a vet?
I did, for 6 weeks.
Did you? Right.
So he really is a vet. And then he went to Cambridge to do his PhD in neuroscience, and he's really been involved in sort of research in the biology of myelin repair and looking at strategies that you can use for the regenerative processes, how they can be enhanced, particularly in things like in diseases such as multiple sclerosis. So he's currently the director of, as I say, the MS Society's Centre. He's also director of the Neural Stem Cell Programme at the Wellcome Trust MRC Cambridge Stem Cell Institute and the head of Translational Science. So he's done some fabulous research over the years, and I look forward to hearing him. So welcome.
Chris, thank you very much for the introduction and the invitation, and thank you all very much for coming. I guess since we're a fairly small, relatively informal group, I don't know if Oxford does it formal, but you know, I'm assuming that you do, yeah. Do ask questions if there's something that isn't clear as I go along. So first, let me see if I can work out this. Works. Okay, so here's a character that I'm sure you, whoops, not that one. Here's a character that I'm sure you all know. This is Carl, one of the founding fathers of our discipline, who famously wrote in 1928 that once development was ended, the founts of growth and regeneration dried up irrevocably, everything may die, nothing may regenerate. And this rather sort of bleak statement has over many decades sort of formed the touchstone of our view of the regenerative capacity of the central nervous system. Now, Cahal's statement, of course, is undoubtedly true for this cell, the neuron. So if you lose neurons in the central nervous system, there's precious little by way of spontaneous regeneration of neurons, which is why most neurodegenerative diseases are progressive. You transect an axon in the central nervous system, there's precious little by way of spontaneous regeneration of cut axons. So for this cell type, Cahal's statement, one wouldn't challenge. But of course, there are other cell types within the central nervous system, famously, dismissively described as the glue or the glia by Virchow in the middle of the 19th century. But of course, now becoming much more mainstream and realization that the other cells of the central nervous system are perhaps every bit as important to the whole function of the organ as the nerve cell. And here are those other cell types. The microglial cells, which are the cells of the mating system, which take up residence in the central nervous system. All tissues in the body have their own population of innate immune cells. And then the classical glial cells of neuroepithelial origin, the astrocytes and the oligodendrocyte. So what I'm really going to do in this talk is challenge Carl's statement with particular reference to the myelinating cell in the central nervous system. So here is a very simple representation of the central nervous system. Here are three neurons with axons heading off to the right where they'll make contact with other neurons and form the circuitry of the CNS. of all but the very smallest diameter atoms in CNS, the atoms covered in this repeated pattern of minor sheaths made in the CNS by the oligodendrocyte. Now, as Chris indicated in his introduction, there are a number of diseases that specifically target, as the primary target cell, not the neuron, but the myelinating cell, the oligodendrocyte. On top of the list of those diseases is multiple sclerosis, the acquired autoimmune disease of the CNS. And if you lose oligodendrocytes, then of course they're no longer able to make and sustain myelin sheaths, so you get primary demyelination. Demyelination being the term that is specifically used for the loss of myelin around an axon that remains intact. Demyelination is not the loss of myelin, it's the loss of myelin around an axon that remains intact. Now, this is a pathology in the central nervous system that is profoundly different to the pathologies that primarily target the neurons. So, as we've already said, if you lose neurons, there's no spontaneous replenishment of neurons. But if you lose oligodendrocytes, the default response, the response that you would expect to happen in the central nervous system, is a spontaneous regenerative process in which you generate new oligodendrocytes that make new myelin sheaths and restore both the architecture and the function of the tissue. So this is a true regenerative response. You can restore the cellular constituents and the architecture and the function of the tissue. So this is something that has interested me for many years. And so I would sort of regard myself as a regeneration biologist. I'm interested in how tissues regenerate, and specifically how this particular cell type regenerates. And that, of course, has translation implications as well. That's how as we go on. So we spent a number of years figuring out how you replace new oligodendrocytes. And the next series of slides is really, before I get onto that, this is what remyelination looks like in the central nervous system. So here is an electron micrograph of one of our experimental models. It's a model developed by my PhD supervisor, Bill Blakemore, many years ago, which involved injecting toxins into the central nervous system to kill oligodendrocytes, and so you can study the replacement of oligodendrocytes. These types of models will be featured consistently through the rest of the talk. They're not models of multiple sclerosis, I should add. They're models for studying the biology of tissue regeneration. So what you see here are both, these are transverse sections of axons. What you see are both myelinated axons and remyelinated axons. So the thick myelin sheaths are around axons that were myelinated in development. The thin myelin sheaths are axons that have previously been fully demyelinated and have had myelin sheaths restored to them. And one of the things you notice is that whereas in development there is a relationship between the thickness of the axon and the thickness of the myelin sheath, so the bigger the axon, the bigger the myelin sheath, this relationship breaks down in remyelination for reasons that are still very unclear. So if you see these two axons here and here, the thicker axon has a thicker myelin sheath, but these two axons are probably about the same diameter, these two here, have exactly the same myelin sheath. So that's a quirk, a peculiarity of remyelination, which is actually quite helpful because it enables us to unambiguously identify remyelination and distinguish it from normal myelination. So how does this regenerative process occur? How do you generate new oligodendrocytes that make these new myelin sheaths around these previously demyelinated axons? So here's a slightly more complicated representation of the central nervous system with axons running left to right. These are oligodendrocytes, these are astrocytes, these are microglial cells. And the other cell type that is critical to this process is this population of cells that are represented here as bipolar cells. In reality, actually, they're multipolar, but if they were multipolar, it would be hard to distinguish from the other cell types. And this is a population of cells that's very abundant through the whole of the central nervous system. White matter, gray matter, brain and spinal cord, and they go by a variety of different names. So classically, these cells are called oligodendrocyte progenitor cells. They're sometimes also called NG2 cells, both of which I think are not particularly good terms to describe these cells. The first, the oligodendrocyte progenitor cell, implies a lineage restriction, which is actually not a feature of these cells. These cells are certainly bipotential and probably multipotential. And I think the term NG2 cell, it derives from the expression of a surface proteoglycan called NG2. I think it's inherently a daft idea to name any cell on the basis of the expression of a single marker on its surface. So I tend to just regard these cells as adult progenitor cells, and I would probably just call them progenitors for the rest of this talk. And they're very abundant. They constitute probably 6, maybe even 8% of all the cells in the adult central nervous system. Very widely distributed, the same sort of distribution density as the microglial cells in the CNS. So if one were to pop into that area of white matter, a demyelinating insult, where you lose oligodendrocytes, the myelin will come off the axon and form myelin debris. That process, that change in the homeostasis of the tissue, is immediately registered by the microglial cells, and that's one of their functions. That's why you have an 8 million cells resident in adult tissue. And what very quickly happens is that those cells become activated, they produce factors that activate the astrocytes, and within a matter of hours, those two cells in the activated state secrete signals, of which there are many, which wake up the progenitor cell, progenitor cells in the vicinity, switching them from a quiescent phenotype to an activated phenotype. And that's something we've been very interested in recently. So what are the initial changes in gene expression within the progenitor cell population in response to injury? Because those, of course, will be the seeds of the regenerative process that then unfolds. So this is a dendrogram of hierarchical clustering of gene expressions, as some of you published at the beginning of last year, where we isolated, this is where we did in collaboration with Kevin Vesky's lab in Paris, where we isolated oligodendrocytes in the adult, progenitor cells from the intact normal adult, progenitor cells of development, the neonatal progenitor cell, and then also progenitor cells isolated from injured white matter, so the activated cells. And what was very striking is that actually the resting progenitor in the adult central nervous system has a very different pattern of gene expression to the progenitor cell of development. In fact, it has a pattern of gene expression that is closer to the mature oligodendrocyte. But when you injure tissue, the activated progenitor cell reverts and starts to have a pattern of gene expression which is much closer to the progenitor cell, which actually, if you think about it, is perfectly reasonable. In a sense, that's what you expect. So these are the two cells that have to prime themselves to make new oligodendrocytes, either in development or in regeneration. And the changes in gene expression that occur within the activated adult progenitor cell are very specific and very bespoke. So here's an example of one of those genes that changes its pattern of gene expression following injury. This is something we published towards the end of last year. So SOX2, this is one of the canonical stem cell transcription factors. In the resting white matter, it's not expressed within these red oligodendrocyte image cells. So blue indicates expression of SOX2. But then when you induce toxin-induced demyelination, the progenitor cells suddenly express very high levels of SOX2, which you see in situ hybridization in blue. And this is not just an epiphenomenon, this is a critical change of gene expression for the ensuing regenerative process, because if you do a conditional ablation of SOX2 within the oligodendrocyte lineage using an oligodendrocyte Cre driver, you profoundly impair the regenerative process. So these are these areas of injury. And the dark blue dots are new oligodendrocytes, and the control that they repopulate in the absence of SOX2, there's profoundly impaired remyelination, which you can see, you may also be able to see here in these electron micrographs. New myelin sheaths in the control, none in the SOX2 ablated animals. So these changes in gene expression that occur in activation prime the cell for the subsequent regenerative process. So in response to all of the many chemotractants and mitogens generated primarily by the activated microglial cells and astrocytes, these cells proliferate and migrate and they enter the area of demyelination. And so you see very quickly this rapid repopulation of the injured area with progenitor cells. Now, it's a fair bet, and I've sort of intimated this in what I've been saying, it's a fair bet that these progenitor cells are what's going to give rise to the oligodendrocytes, but that needs to be formally proven. And so we did this a few years ago using what then wasn't, but now is a pretty standard genetic fate mapping strategy where we specifically express the marker protein within the oligodendrocyte lineage. So this is transverse section of a mouse which is expressing the reporter gene within the progenitor cell population. Ignore this bit for the time being. So this is an inducible Cre. And the recombination efficiency is about 30-40%. So what you see here throughout the transverse section of this mouse spinal cord is about 30-40% of the progenitor cells are actually present within these 2 micron thick sections. Now, what we've done here is to induce an air of demyelination by injecting our demyelinating toxin. And this is just a few days after it, so you can see the density of progenitor cells is much higher within the injured area than it is in the non-injured tissue. So this is the recruitment of the progenitor cells. And because these progenitors are now expressing a marker gene, you can follow what happens to them as this wound heals, as regeneration takes place. So this is 3 weeks after the induction of injury, where we know histologically that remyelination is complete. And what you see here are new myelin sheaths. They're PLP positive, so the red structures are new myelin sheaths. It would be a highly skeptical person who would not be persuaded that this green cell here is not responsible for making that red myelin sheath. Of course, those people do exist in the world of reviewers. And I wonder where they are, actually, because everybody I meet in meetings seems to be very nice, but then it's clear this population of anonymous reviewers that aren't so pleasant. Anyway, we didn't finally manage to persuade the reviewers that this was the case. So this oligodendrocyte, which has clearly come from a progenitor cell, because those are the only cells we pre-labeled, is responsible for making their new myelin sheath. Therefore, it is this recruited population of progenitor cells which make the new oligodendrocytes that are responsible for remyelination to occur. One of the outstanding questions in the field for many years has been whether or not the oligodendrocyte per se is able to generate new oligodendrocytes. So can oligodendrocytes beget oligodendrocytes? So I won't show you the data, but we've also just recently published another fate mapping study where we've expressed the marker gene exclusively within the oligodendrocyte and find no evidence that new oligodendrocytes are coming from pre-labeled oligodendrocytes. So remyelination is mediated by this population of progenitor cells throughout the whole of the central nervous system. It's just,
So they were migrating in, do they migrate?
They migrate over very short distances, right. So most of the repopulation is proliferation. So the recruitment is a combination of migration and proliferation, but mainly proliferation. Okay, so, right, so, I have suggested thus far that this is a homogeneous population of progenitor cells in the adult, and that has certainly been the view for many years. But as it happens, the oligodendrocytes and their progenitors in the adult come from distinct developmental origins. So one of the questions we asked recently was whether the developmental origin of the oligodendrocyte progenitor cell has any bearing on how it behaves in the adult central nervous system. So no a priori reason why there should be any difference in how they behave in the adult, they come from different developmental origins, but nevertheless, it seemed to ask a question that was worth asking, and we're glad we did. So this developmental heterogeneity of the oligodendrocyte image is most easily seen within the spinal cord, given the simplicity of the structure of the spinal cord compared to the brain. So in the spinal cord, this is very early developmental spinal cord, there are distinct dorsal and ventral origins of oligodendrocytes and their progenitors under distinct transcriptional regulation. And those distinctive transcriptional regulators enable you to generate a double reporter mouse where you differentially label the cells of dorsal and ventral origin either red or green. So this was a mouse that was developed by Bill Richardson, who we collaborated with over many years. And this is a wonderful picture of these mice generated by Risha Tripathi in Bill's lab. And you can see the distribution of cells of ventral origin in green and dorsal origin in red. And clearly, the dorsal cells are preferentially located in the dorsal spinal cord, although the dominant population is clearly those of ventral origin. So if you look down here in the ventral white matter, what you might perceive is that while the majority of the cells are ventral origin, there are also dotted around a small number of cells of dorsal origin. So the question we asked was whether if you induce demyelination of ventral white matter, when those lesions undergo complete repopulation, is the distribution of dorsal ventral cells the same as it is in the pre-lesion tissue? And if it is, then the progenitor cells are exactly the same in functional terms. And if they're different, then they're clearly not the same in terms of their regenerative capacity. So this is just to show you a slightly higher power view of the ventral white matter before we induce demyelination. And clearly the majority of the cells are green with a few number of red cells. But this is what happens when we induce demyelination in the same area of the white matter of the spinal cord. This is 21 days after we've induced demyelination. So the lesion has undergone complete regeneration.
This is in an adult,
yeah. So these are 3 months plus. And so what you see pretty clearly is that the number of red cells is higher than you would expect given their distribution before you induce demyelination. And that's shown quantitatively here. So I apologize for your red green color blind, but these are coded. For dorsal and ventral cells. So pre lesion, the majority of cells are ventral origin, a much smaller proportion of those cells are dorsal origin. But when the lesion undergoes complete regeneration, you can see there's a disproportionate contribution from the dorsally derived cells relative to ventrally derived cells. So actually, the developmental origin of the progenitor cell does determine its regenerative capacity. Both cells regenerate, but the dorsally derived cells do it more efficiently. And actually, I think this is the first example of heterogeneity within an adult regenerative population manifesting the differences in their regenerative capacity. And as you might imagine, there is now a large project in the lab figuring out what the differences are between the dorsal and ventral cells. And let me just tell you that it's not simple. There are lots of differences, and it's probably a whole combination of different genes expressed between the two cells that account for this difference in behavior. But this is something that struck us as very interesting. There is a heterogeneity within the adult progenitor population in terms of their ability to regenerate. Okay, so what I've described to you so far is this highly efficient regenerative process. But it is well established and well known that in chronic demyelinating diseases, such as MS, as you progress through the disease, the efficiency of the regenerative process becomes less and less. And this is not good news. So there are two things that myelin sheaths do. One is that they confer cell tissue reduction. We've known about that for decades. The other thing myelin sheaths do, which has really only emerged in the last 15 years or so, is that they're fundamentally important for the survival, the integrity of the underlying axon. So axons that have had myelin sheaths become dependent on that myelin sheath for some sort of trophic fix, the nature of which is only really beginning to emerge in the last few years or so. The point being that if you don't put a myelin sheath back on a demyelinated axon, that axon becomes highly vulnerable and is likely to degenerate. And of course, as we've already said, you lose axons in the central nervous system, that's an irreversible change. And actually, that is the substrate which underpins the progressive phase of the disease. You reach a point where the regenerative process is not sufficient to protect axons, so the axons degenerate and the disease becomes progressive. So here's what I've shown you so far is just pure regeneration biology, how the tissue regenerates. But here's a translation important question. Why does this regenerative process become less efficient as you progress through a disease such as MS, which is a disease commonly of many decades duration, frequently diagnosed in individuals in the early 20s, life expectancy of some of the MS only reduced by 5 or 6 years, and that number is brought down because of suicides of people with chronic disease. So the people live for much of their adult life with this disease, with their regenerative process becoming less and less efficient. So why should this be? So what is the single most important determinant of regeneration in any tissue in the body? If you step outside the slightly sort of claustrophobic world of MS research, or even myelin research, or even neuroscience, and think as a biologist about regenerative processes, it's well established that the single most important determinant of any regenerative process is aging. The inescapable event of aging. And that, of course, is one of the reasons we age, because we don't regenerate so well. So there's a clear relationship between aging and regeneration. Well established in wound healing, well established in bone regeneration, absolutely true of myelin regeneration. So this must be, the effects of aging and remyelination must be a very profound determinant of the progression of chronic demyelinating disease. So we've been studying this now for many years, why remyelination becomes less efficient as you get older. And if you think of this model of how remyelination takes place, there are several possibilities. So one possibility is that as you get older, the number of progenitor cells you have available for regeneration declines. That's not an unreasonable supposition. As it happens, there's no evidence for that. So the number of progenitor cells in the central nervous system stays pretty much constant throughout the whole of adulthood, certainly in rodents, and as far as one can tell in humans as well. So the other possibility is that they don't activate as well and they don't recruit so well. And there is some evidence that that is the case, and certainly there is a delay in activation recruitment in aging progenitor cells. But to cut a very long story short, what we have done in a series of papers is provide really quite clear evidence, to my mind, that the bottleneck that occurs with aging is this final stage where the progenitor cell has to differentiate into an oligodendrocyte. That is the thing that really gets screwed up as a function of aging. Which is not surprising, really, because cell migration, cell proliferation, these are pretty generic bits of cell biology. But the differentiation of a multipotent cell into a highly specialized cell, this is a bit of bespoke biochemistry. So that is the thing that gets screwed up as you get older. So why should it be? Why should these cells find it harder to become oligodendrocytes as you get older? At a very simple level, there are two possibilities. One is that the signals that instruct those cells to become oligodendrocytes change as a function of aging. And that's true. We published a whole series of papers describing environmental changes that occur as a function of aging, both molecules and cells, and macrophages, which we know are important for remyelination, their function changes as a result of aging. The other possibility is that there are intrinsic changes taking place within the progenitor cell as a function of aging. And we know a little bit about that, but not as much as we'd like to know. Now, the fact that there are intrinsic changes taking place with this progenitor population, rendering them less efficient at becoming oligodendrocytes as you get older, has very profound implications for how you might devise a regeneration or remyelination therapy. So if the changes that occur with aging in these cells are irreversible, then really the only way that you're going to regenerate myelin in an aging individual is to replace inefficient cells with efficient cells, and that, of necessity, is a cell therapy. Transplantation, in other words. If, on the other hand, these changes are reversible, then the notion of giving a drug to an individual which galvanizes and kickstarts these cells as they get older and make them more efficient to become oligodendrocyte becomes a possibility. So we've addressed this question of whether or not the changes that occur in the progenitor cell are reversible or not a number of years ago using a very powerful model for asking questions about aging and regeneration, and that's the model of heterochronic parabiosis, which many of you will be familiar with. So parabiosis is a model developed in the 1930s by immunologists, where if you take two mice and join them together, they as the wounds heal when you join them together, they will share a common circulation. So two mice joined by parabiosis share a common circulation. And the trick here is to take an old animal in light gray and hook it up to a young animal in dark gray. So the old animal is now sharing the circulation with the young animal. And when you induce remyelination in the old animal, you ask the question of whether or not sharing the circulation with the young animal does anything to the efficiency of remyelination. So here's our experimental model again. We induce demyelination by killing oligodendrocytes. So as it regenerates, you can follow the efficiency of that regenerative process simply by counting the new oligodendrocytes within this area. And a young animal hooked up to a young animal, it remyelinates very efficiently, so that's the number of oligodendrocytes you need to repair the lesion, which is exactly the same rate as you'd see it with a single young animal as it happens. In an old animal hooked up to a young old animal, it's remyelinating very slowly, so there are fewer oligodendrocytes at this time point. But in an old animal that's hooked up to a young animal, the remyelination is now not significantly different from a young animal, but is significantly more efficient than an old animal. In other words, by doing this heterochronic parabiosis, we've made an old animal remyelinate as a young animal. I should make it clear, this is a purely experimental approach, and when we published this, we'd be amazed at the number of people that were flying off to Transylvania for all sorts of bizarre ways of promoting remyelination. There is a mechanism behind this, which is very complicated. Now, actually, for the purpose of the rest of the talk, it's not really what I want to dwell on. The point here is that if you change the environment of an old lesion, you can make the old progenitors remyelinate as efficiently as young progenitors. So actually, if you think about the implications of that, what it means is that you don't have to invoke cell therapy as a means of promoting remyelination in the CNS. You can use drugs if you're smart enough that make progenitor cells become oligodendrocytes more efficiently. So the idea of a pharmacological-based regenerative medicine now becomes much more credible plausible than was the case before we demonstrated this principle using parabiosis. So here's the problem with aging. We have to figure out how to make these progenitors become oligodendrocytes more efficiently. So that then gets you into a whole series of studies trying to understand the mechanisms by which a progenitor cell becomes an oligodendrocyte. Here's that principle shown very simply. Here's a CNS progenitor cell that has to differentiate into myosin form oligodendrocyte. And there will be pathways, regulatory pathways, that, hang on a second, let me just finish the sentence. There will be regulatory pathways that induce that differentiation. And there are going to be regulatory pathways, which are negative regulatory pathways, that inhibit that process. So what we need to do is to figure out as many of these as we possibly can, because each of those pathways will, of course, offer opportunities to drug development. Yes, sorry.
On your previous point, is the converse true as well? If you put new cells, new progenitors, into an old environment, will they not work as well?
Yes, so that's a good question. I think if your question, or put your question another way, what happens if you demyelinate the young animal instead of the old animal? So if you demyelinate the young animal, it remyelinates with exactly the same efficiency as if you had it on the parabiosis. So this is not the neutralization of a negative loss of function. This is the provision of a positive gain of function. But that's a good question. We thought of that one because it's expected for review of my ask, to be sure.
So
it
tells us that's not cells being.
I wasn't going to go into the mechanisms of this. So it's both actually. Right. So one of the things that the young animal is providing are monocytes, which become macrophages. So actually, what you end up with the macrophages in the old lesion are both young and old. And if you use a CCR2 knockout young donor so they can't recruit monocytes, you abrogate the enhancement of remyelination. So the young monocytes that become young macrophages are actually very helpful to this rejuvenation. But it's also humoral factors as well. So cells and molecules, yeah. Okay, so what do we know about the differentiation mechanisms? So these are the ones that we've identified so far. Some of them are positive regulatory pathways, some of them are negative regulatory pathways. And I will sort of illustrate our work with a reference to the first of these RXR gamma, because actually that is the one that has got us closest to the clinic, and then just mention briefly the work of vitamin D as well. Okay, so the RXR story started many years ago when, and this is so long ago, this was in the days of microarrays, so RNA-seq was a term which you weren't even familiar with, so this was all microarray data. And so what we wanted to do was to, we spent a lot of time guessing about molecules, so we thought it was high time we got a very comprehensive picture of all of the things involved in the different stages of the regenerative process. So this is a variant of the model of demyelination that I've showed you so far, where we demyelinate these large white matter tracts in the rodent brainstem, which are called the caudal cerebellar peduncles. They'd be in human neural anatomy, the inferior cerebellar peduncles. We inject a demyelinating toxin into them. The axons become demyelinated. At 5 days, this is peak recruitment of progenitor cells. So 5 days after a new that's when progenitor numbers are their highest. There's as yet no new myosheath formation. Then they start to differentiate into myosheath forming oligodendrocytes at day 10. So by day 14, you begin to see new myosheath differentiations well underway. And at 21 days, the lesion is completely remyelinated. So you use laser capture microdissection to take out lesions, and you can extract RNA and do your microarray profiling. So, as you all know, when you do these exercises, you obtain more data than most biologists are comfortable with dealing with. So you have to interrogate it using some very simple predictions. And our prediction was that genes that were higher at 5 days compared to 14 days are likely genes associated with recruitment, whereas conversely, genes that are higher at 14 days compared to 5 days would likely be genes associated with differentiation. And of course, that's the process that we're particularly interested in differentiation. So we went hunting in our data sets to find genes that were much higher at the point of differentiation than they were at the point of recruitment. And one of the ways you identify those genes is using volcano plots. So this is the fidelity of hit up here. Each of these dots is an individual transcript or species of transcript. This is fold increase at 14 days compared to 5 days. This is fold decrease at 14 days compared to 5 days. So if your gene is skewed in this direction, the volcano is going to be involved in different recruitment. If it's skewed in this direction, it's going to be involved in differentiation. So you can verify that prediction by looking up in the top right quadrant, and that's where you'd expect to see genes associated with myelin sheath formation. So all of those colored circles are genes expressing proteins that you find in the new myelin sheath. So that sort of supports our idea. Conversely, if you want to, if the prediction is true, then you should find progenitor markers in this direction. That blue dot there is a progenitor marker, AKX2.2. Now, what struck us was this gene sitting here, pretty much in pole position in this volcanic plot analysis. It was this gene RXR gamma, which is a member of this really interesting family of proteins, the nuclear receptors, which are both big proteins with the ligand binding domain and the DNA binding domain, so they're receptors and transcription factors in the same molecule. So RXR gamma had never appeared in the oligonucleotide literature, but here it was sitting in pole position at a time expressed at a time when progenitors are becoming oligodendrocytes. Now, mercifully, this is a gene that has been extensively studied in cancer biology. So there's a whole slew of small molecule agonists and antagonists for this receptor. So armed with those, you can ask some very simple questions about what RXR signaling does in terms of progenitor cell differentiation. So these are cultured progenitor cells. If they're red, they're immature. If they're green, they're mature. So red means less differentiated. Green means more differentiated. If you slap on this isomeric form of retinoic acid, which is not the same as all trans retinoic acid, this is a different form of retinoic acid, but it's a specific or preferential ligand for the RXR, then you induce differentiation, which is reversible if you put on an antagonist. So these very simple experiments using these small molecule agonists and antagonists gives you a hint that this is a molecule involved as a positive regulator of differentiation of progenitor cells. And you would predict, therefore, that if you use the RXR knockout mouse, there should be a delay in differentiation of progenitor cells and slowing of remyelination. That's certainly true, so we show that as well. And then the final prediction is this. So if you take an aged animal, it's remyelinating slowly, and it's remyelinating slowly because the progenitor cells are struggling to differentiate. So if you give an agonist for a receptor which is involved in the differentiation of progenitor cells, you should be able to accelerate the efficiency of remyelination in an old animal, which actually, in translational terms, is what we're trying to do in the clinic. So these are old animals. These are old rats of 12 months plus. This is an electron micrograph of the edge of the lesion, normally myelinated axons, lots of demyelinated axons, which you don't see so clearly because they're not defined by an electron dense myelin sheath. And then some of these axons are beginning to acquire new myelin sheaths, so we make them pink so you can see them more easily. And in these old animals, the remyelination is pretty slow. It's progressing at a snail's pace. But if you lob in an agonist for the RXR receptor, lysis retinoic acid, boom, there's accelerated differentiation and more myelin sheath formation, and that's just shown quantitatively here in a ranking analysis. The higher the point, the more remyelination, conversely, the lower the less. And you can see that those that receive lysis retinoic acid are nearly all remyelinating more efficiently than controls.
Is that or in the drinking water? Do you inject that? Or?
This was given by systemic injection. So this was actually really very exciting to us. It made us think that actually targeting RXR might be a useful way of promoting remyelination therapeutically. But there are a number of questions that you want answered before you make that leap. First thing we want to know is whether or not RXR is expressed within our target disease within the right cell type. So we collaborated with our colleague in Paris, Mesmer, who's using tissue from the UK MS Tissue Bank. And we showed that RXR is expressed within oligodendrocyte NHL cells within MS lesions. So SOX10 and OLIG1 are both transcription factors expressed within the oligodendrocyte NHL, and there is co-labeling of these two transcription factors with the nuclear receptor. So that's one of the boxes you might want to tick if you were thinking about using this therapeutically. The other thing you'd want to know is whether or not RXR signaling does the same thing in human progenitor cells as it does in rodent progenitor cells. Likely, but it's not a given. So what we did here was to use human embryonic stem cells, which we then differentiate into human progenitor cells, and did the same experiment. So this is increased differentiation of progenitor cells. If you give an agonist for RXI, you can increase differentiation as reversible of an antagonist. So all of this was really rather encouraging. The story we developed in rodent systems, as far as we could tell, was going to be true in human tissue. So the next question you ask is, well, are there any drugs in existence, licensed, that target RXR that you could repurpose as a regenerative medicine in MS? And as it happens, there is one. It's this drug here called Bexarotene, or Targaryen, as its trade name. This is a selective RXR agonist developed for use as a treatment for T-cell lymphoma, cutaneous lymphoma. So we have due to start very shortly, just as soon as the company has made a sufficient number out of this drug for us to use, after a very long and tortuous process, which has been a real eye-opener for me about the time frame it takes to translate laboratory things into the clinic. I mean, I always naively believe that science was the tricky bit. I've been completely disabused of that view as a result of trying to get this this trial launched. So we will be doing a trial in the not-too-distant future, hopefully starting within this calendar year, collaboration between our centre in Cambridge, led by Alistair Coles, and our colleagues in Edinburgh, team led by Siddharthan Chandran. We will be using Bexarotene specifically as a regenerative medicine in MS patients. There are a number of these trials beginning around the world using medicines to promote remyelination, some of which have a sounder scientific basis than others. Some of which have no scientific basis, but that's by the by. Okay, so let me just tell you a little bit more about RXRs. RXRs, and many people know this, are a fascinating group of molecules. They only ever function as heterodimers. And the RXRs are highly promiscuous. There's a whole slew of nuclear receptors that function by dimerizing with RXR. So the classical retinoic acid receptor functions by binding with RXR. And there are a number of others here, the vitamin D receptor, pyrrolobin receptor, PPARs, and so on. And we have a large program of work in the lab sort of figuring out what the binding partners are in the oligonucleotide lineage that are responsible for this control of differentiation. But one that we published on last year is really very interesting because it turns out that one of the key binding partners of the RXRs is vitamin D receptor. And this is some of the data. These are pulled out studies to show binding of vitamin D receptor and RXR gamma within progenitor cells. These are dual-link studies showing combined the two molecules are actually linked to each other. If you use vitamin D, you can induce differentiation or encourage differentiation of progenitor cells, and you can reverse that with knockdown studies for the receptor. So this is really quite interesting because those of you who have been following the MS field over the last 10 years will know that vitamin D is all the rage as a susceptibility factor in MS. If you don't have enough vitamin D, your susceptibility to get the disease is decreased. So people who live in parts of the world where there isn't much sun don't get so much vitamin D. They have a much higher susceptibility to MS, which is probably why Scotland is the MS center of the world. They don't see very much sun up there, apparently. But this is putting vitamin D in a completely different context within the disease. This has nothing to do with disease susceptibility. This is vitamin D as a cleaner role in the regenerative process once injury has taken place. So the notion of vitamin D supplementation MS now takes on extra impetus as something which I think vitamin D alone is not going to make you regenerate, but you will certainly change the baseline of the likelihood of remyelination by maintaining high vitamin D levels. So speaking of things that you might ingest that change the efficiency of remyelination, I'm just going to finish by telling you about some unpublished data which we're very excited about in the lab because it's really quite spectacular. So as I mentioned earlier, one of the things we're very interested in is how cells age, how progenitor cells age. And there are two things that are known in biology that profoundly affect the nature of the aging process. One is exercise. The more exercise you do as you get older, the better. And the other thing that profoundly affects the process of aging is calorie restriction. And there is a little bit of evidence, not much, that calorie restriction is helpful for tissue regeneration. So an experiment we decided to do was as follows. We're going to take rats that are already pretty old, 12-month-old rats. And over the next 6 months, half of them we were going to feed ad libitum, and half of them we were going to calorie restrict by alternate day fasting. And then with the grand old age of 18 months, which is really pretty old for a rat, we reduce demyelination and look at the efficiency of myelin regeneration. These rats, of course, get huge, not to say obese. These rats stay pretty trim. This is what happens in the control animals. So these are the animals that have just been fed ad libitum. Here's the edge of the lesion, normally myelinated axons. This is the lesion. And the remyelination is pathetic. It's occurring very slowly. In all likelihood, these animals will die before remyelination is complete. And that's what we'd seen in the past. But when we looked at the calorie-restricted animals, it was dramatic. The lesions are completely remyelinated. This animal, at 18 months old, is remyelinating with pretty much the efficiency of a 3-month-old animal. Now, there is a whole backstory to this about why this is happening. It has to do with changes in mTOR signaling, HIF stabilization, and changes in wound pathway. But since my time is almost up, I will not share that with you. Just suffice to say, I mean, this is the important part of this data. The calorie restriction really does profoundly affect remyelination efficiency. So just to summarize, within the stem cell hullabaloo that has gripped medicine over the last 10 years or so, I think within the neurological diseases, the disease that really lends itself to regenerative intervention is MS, because there is an inherent regenerative process which is not true of the classic neurodegenerative diseases, and the opportunity of regalvanizing something that works anyway is a lower hurdle than the idea of reconstitution of circuits which have no inherent regenerative capacity. And I would just say as an aside, I think in neurodegenerative diseases, the strategy is not going to be one of regeneration or one of disease prevention. Remyelination is mediated by progenitor cells, but not all progenitor cells in the adult have the same regenerative capacity. There is heterogeneity. Aging is the most profound determinant of efficiency of this regenerative process, and indeed all regenerative processes. But they can be reversed by physiological interventions, such as parabiosis and calorie restriction. We don't know about exercise yet, we haven't done those experiments. But actually, what this does is to give you insights into mechanisms by which you can develop mechanisms-based small molecule approaches for regenerative medicines. And so that's why this talk is called Mechanisms to Medicines. I'm a firm believer that the regenerative medicines are only going to take place if you understand regenerative biology. I think funders have been slightly naive about regenerative medicine and have not invested sufficiently in understanding the mechanisms of regenerative processes, but that doubts will come. So I meant to mention them to the lab who've done the work, but forgot. This is Bjorn, who's done the calorie restriction work, various collaborators who've helped with this work, and various funders who've allowed it to happen. Thank you for your attention.